This is Vermont Edition, a production of Vermont Public Radio. This program is made possible by the support of listeners like you. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. December 28, 2009, the Crown Point Bridge between Crown Point, New York and Chimney Point, Vermont is demolished. Many history buffs were sad to see a significant architectural landmark disappear into the frigid waters of Lake Champlain. But what the crumbling of that bridge revealed has excited historians even more. The remains of what appears to be a nearly 300-year-old French fort, long covered, have been found on the Vermont side of the lake. Archaeologists and historians have known that the French settled in this area, but the exact whereabouts of the fort were still mainly just a hunch. In the summer of 2007, archaeologists, historians, and volunteers explored the lakeshore at DAR State Park, looking for signs of early French settlement. Elsa Gilbertson was the director of that project.
A lot of people think that maybe settlement in Vermont didn't really happen till after the Revolution, but starting in the mid-1740s, there was a permanent French domestic settlement in this area, and they built, we think, foundations of stone with houses all along the lake, and they started farms, and they planted apple trees and the like, and they not only provided food for themselves, but they also provided food for the soldiers at the fort. And it's kind of interesting to think of this French domestic life on a military frontier. And, you know, it might have been a little frightening in a way. There is so much left to learn to paint this picture and make the history come alive again.
But it's been difficult to find signs of French settlement and French life in the early 18th century. This French fort, built in 1731 in the area then known as Pointe à la Chevelure, could help change that. We're going to talk about why with state archaeologist Giovanna Peebles in our Montpelier studio. Hi, Giovanna.
Hey, hello. How are you, Jane?
Great, thank you.
I'm sorry I'm not there with you, but
I wish you were.
Gorgeous, sunny Montpelier. I hate not seeing you and John eye to eye, but I'm going to pretend your shadow is right in front of me.
Well, we're happy to have you in Montpelier. And sitting across from me, who I can see face to face, is John Kroc, director of the Consulting Archaeology Program at the University of Vermont, which conducted the dig at this site with the Vermont Agency of Transportation and the Division for Historic Preservation. John, it's nice to have you here.
Thanks, Jane. Great to be here.
Now, Giovanna, I'd like to start with you. The Crown Point Bridge was demolished at the very end of 2009, as we all remember and we just heard. Why did the state start digging around the piers then, and what were you hoping to find?
Can I just ratchet the story back? Since
yeah.
we have some time, I'm going to sort of take advantage of having the podium and ignore your question for a minute.
Uh-oh.
If that's the license here. I want to start at the beginning that, Elsa was just on the air right now. Elsa Gilbertson is the administrator of our Chimney Point State Historic Site in Addison. And I've known Elsa for 33 years. You know, I've been state archaeologist here from the beginning in 1976. And Elsa is this utterly brilliant, can-do, let's do this. And in January, or actually December of 2005, Elsa got a little postcard from this funding agency in Washington called the Institute of Museum and Library Services. And they said, well, why don't you apply for a grant? So Elsa hooked several of us in. We applied in March of 2006 for $250,000 grant, and we brought in Vermont Public Television, the Chimney Point site, our Division for Historic Preservation, with whom I work in the Agency of Commerce. We brought in Bixby Memorial Library and came up with this incredible two-year multimedia, multi-event research project. So that's kind of where it started, because one of my dilemmas as being state archaeologist is I've had to be a bit of a generalist. So all of a sudden, we said, let's showcase this French settlement in the Champlain Valley, because none of us learned about it in grade school. So those of us that went to school in Vermont, practically, unless you lived in Vergennes, you probably did not know a whole lot about the French settlements. And I started school in Vermont in eighth grade. My kids all did school in Vermont, and no one ever learned about the French settlements. But the interesting thing about getting a grant is, and John knows this, and everyone out there who's listening who's been forced to learn something that's not something you think about every day, it forced us to do research around this whole topic that we were just not familiar with. And one of the things that came across so loudly is that this traditional history that we learn, Champlain, 1492, the Indians, we'll get to that a little bit more in the story. Things were not quite as black and white. And then when we got into the quadricentennial with 1609, I actually had people saying, oh, the first Europeans in the New World, Champlain in 1609, in at least the northern New World. So other than the story starting with Elsa applying for the grant, successfully getting this $250,000 grant to showcase Lake Champlain as the center of international history in the small period of time and really put ourselves out there, and Chimney Point in particular as the center of this piece of geography that was of international importance. And so let me think where I was going with this.
Well, what we want to know, because, we all heard about this demolition, and you think, okay, there's the bridge gone, a new bridge is going to be built. And then out of the rubble comes this fort that, people kind of knew was there but kind of didn't know. And suddenly we have in the rubble a 300-year-old fort. So what made you decide to go ahead and dig through the rubble once the bridge was demolished?
Well, we always knew, we have been studying to some extent the history of Chimney Point for a very long time, and Elsa and her predecessors knew it very well. But where I was going with this big grant at the DAR State Park, it forced us to study the entire French settlement area, which, although there were 115,000 acres in this French plantation in the 18th century, only about, let's see, I think there were as many as 150 people were actually settled in the Champlain Valley in that period of time. So we started studying this area and knew all along that in 1731, the French had built a fort right here at Chimney Point. And we knew that by 1735, Fort St. Frederick was built across the way, this extraordinary medieval fort. And if you look at European medieval forts with the tower and the moat, I mean, this is what Fort St. Frederick was across the way. And there were all these settlers who were both north of Chimney Point in the town of Addison and Panton, and south of Chimney Point in the town of Bridport. And so the 1731 fort is something that we always knew would be there. When I started working as state archaeologist in the summer of 76, Bill Pinney, who was my old boss, took me to Chimney Point and said, there's a story that this pier right here on the Vermont side of the bridge was built right into a French cellar hole because they found early, 1740s, French material culture. So the story that I've brought to this all these years was, when I first started working here, I heard about the pier being built practically on top of the cellar hole. So when John was hired by the Agency of Transportation as part of very rapid archaeological deployment, we had this crisis in mid-October. The bridge can no longer be used. Jane, I can't tell you the extent of engagement. We all just jumped on board. The VTrans engineers, the historic preservationists at the Agency of Transportation, our team at the Division for Historic Preservation, John Kroc at the Consulting Archaeology Program at UVM, who is the consulting arm for one of the consultants for VTrans on archaeology. Everybody just jumped together in this little boat and said, let's get this going. And so part of that, Jane, going back to your question, is we knew that there was at least some evidence of French right there under the pier. What did not surprise us, because we've seen this over and over again in Vermont archaeology, is that in 1928-29, when they built this bridge, contractors were very parsimonious in terms of their excavation footprint. And I'll turn the floor over momentarily to John, and he can better describe this experience that we had right here under the pier, but that we've had over and over in Vermont, that you can have this incredibly important, nationally significant, internationally significant archaeological site inches away from this construction project, and it was not harmed in that earlier part of our construction history.
Well, that's pretty amazing in and of itself, that when we built this bridge in 1929, this site wasn't ruined. And I do want to bring John Kroc into the conversation, but I want to pause for a moment because we have a lot of listeners who are really excited about this story. And I want to let you know that if you have a question about this French fort that's been uncovered, you can call 1-800-639-2211, 1-800-639-2211, or send an email to Vermont Edition at vpr.net. Now, John Kroc, you are the director of the UVM Consulting Archaeology Program. You were conducting this dig of the site once the bridge was demolished. Can you take us to the moment where you started to uncover something that you thought, oh my, this is historically significant?
Yeah, I think, you know, we were working both for the temporary ferry crossing that was used. We did some testing there, very preliminary work in advance of the construction of that, and then really some very small holes, not very many, underneath the bridge, just really to see if there was any integrity to archaeological deposits there. Everybody had assumed a little bit, I did, that there had been a lot of destruction during the construction of the original bridge, and even though we knew the French fort had been there, the question was, what remains, and is it intact? And, you know, not only did we find a fragment of a wall, which I'll say right now is I am not fully convinced it is the French fort, and I have to be careful about that.
Archaeologists are the most conservative people you have ever met.
As I was just telling
Except for me, who tends to go out there a teeny bit more.
I was just telling my students this morning, you know, the history of archaeology is filled with people who make bold statements and then are found to be incorrect. So I'm doing my best to be careful with this, and we have a very small area opened up. But in addition to finding a wall construction with the sort of right type of artifacts, date-wise, and the right orientation, we also found evidence of an early pottery-making facility there that was used by a man, Moses Bradley, in the late 1700s, 1790. But more importantly, evidence of Native American activity that dates back at Chimney Point to as much as 9,000 years ago. And so the exciting thing for me was not just one of these things, but the whole package, the whole point being a center of activity both for transportation and communication dating back well into the Native American era, right up to the present. I mean, you know, there's still negotiations, communications, and trade and exchange going on now between engineers from New York and Vermont. But incredible to find this evidence right underneath the bridge, and was found prior to the demolition to sort of set up the projects for the future, what might need to be preserved, what further studies can be undertaken before the new bridge is built.
I don't want to veer too far off topic, but just for a moment, because you opened the door here, John, if you don't think it's definitely the French fort, what else could it be?
Well, there was a man, an earlier settler in Addison, Jonah Case, who built a house in the late 1700s, lived there until about 1880, and on a late 19th century stereograph taken from the lake, it pictures a house right up in this area. And so we know, and then later on, the property was improved by the early owners of what became the tavern, the Barnes family. And so there have been some constructions and reconstructions in the area. And so we really want to be careful. Mm-hmm. And also, this is the fort was a fort de pieux, a fort of posts. And
Meaning wood.
And we have a stone foundation. And so there is some documentary evidence that some of these post forts were fortified with a foundation at the base, but we just need more. And we, you know, and this is the typical question of archaeology. It's always we open up more research questions, but we have a very, very clear idea of what we need to do to confirm the presence of the fort here.
And I can verify the story because in 1970, 1976, yeah, when I started, the community in Brattleboro was intent on doing some excavations at the site of Fort Dummer. And the Connecticut River had been lowered by like 15, 20 feet there in Vernon. And so there was all these people excavating. I'd been on the job a month. And they found this beautiful dry-laid stone foundation. And John, as soon as I saw the photograph you emailed me, I did think of the Fort Dummer situation. And so because I was not familiar with 18th century material culture, which is what Fort Dummer was, an early English fortification up there in the Vernon-Brattleboro area, there are these nuances. That's why archaeologists are specialists, because the artifacts from 1740 French are very different from the English artifacts of the 1750s and the 1760s, which are yet more different from the American artifacts of the 1780s. And so since I didn't know what I was looking at, because I had come from an Indian, Native American archaeology background, we all thought we were there in Fort Dummer. We'll come to learn that in 1830, some English settler had built a cellar, had built a house with a beautiful cellar hole and cut across Fort Dummer. So we were indeed finding the evidence of Fort Dummer, but we were also in the middle of an 1830 cellar hole. So what John is saying has happened to us multiple times where we really need to get the evidence. But I'm looking at a picture here of this little publication that was mentioned in Mark Bushnell's marvelous article on Sunday, and look at it on the internet for those listeners who are interested in Mark's summary of this project. It was in the Sunday Rutland Herald Times Argus, Mark Bushnell. Just Google Mark Bushnell, Champlain Bridge Fort. And what I'm seeing, Jane, is that there was this wooden stockade, and of course it's just a drawing. There was a wooden stockade fort there with different buildings within it. So inside the stockade was a building for the commandant of the fort, a chapel. There was a guardhouse as well as a kitchen, a bakery, and a storehouse. So any one of those buildings could have had a foundation. So as John says, we obviously need to do a great deal more research. So that was one reason why we are thinking it might be the fort, because it wasn't just like one fort. It was this wooden stockade with different buildings within it. So the other evidence where Elsa and I were talking about, is this possibly the fort or not, is that we know that the French were experts in making flat glass, like window glass, for panes and mirrors. And John, I have not looked at the glass that you excavated out from under those little test units there near the pier. But what we know is that this window glass was shipped by canoe, if you can picture this, by canoe or bateau. And bateau, the French bateau, essentially were kind of oversized canoe. So this is not like real ships. We're talking about these canoes and then oversized canoes, if you have. And what they did was they put the window glass in vats of molasses, you know, like the molasses we make ginger cookies with. So they were putting this window glass in vats of molasses, in barrels of molasses, and then sending them up the lake to Chimney Point, where they, in fact, were used. Apparently, one inventory was that there were 20 panes of glass, and then the next year, one of the traders brought 200 more panes of window glass here to the French fort in 1731-32. So Peter Kalm, who was... see how much you learn when you're actually researching something?
Well, that's one of the amazing things about archaeology is you're uncovering so many layers of history and trying to get to the bottom, so to speak, and literally speaking of what you're looking for is so difficult when settlements have been built upon settlements. We're going to continue talking about this. Sorry to interrupt you, Giovanna. We have to take a quick break.
Yeah.
We are going to come back, talk a little bit more about the significance of this find, what it could mean for our understanding of history, Vermont history, French and Native American relationships, French and British relationships. If you have a question, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or send an email to vermontedition@vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're exploring the discovery of a long-hidden French fort on the shores of Lake Champlain that wasn't uncovered until the Crown Point Bridge was demolished in late December. John Kroc, who conducted the dig as director of the University of Vermont's Consulting Archaeology Program, and Giovanna Peebles, Vermont State Archaeologist, are both here helping us
understand what this means for our knowledge of Vermont's colonial history. And they're answering your questions. What do you want to know about how this changes our understanding of French and British interactions or French and Native American interactions? You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or send an email to vermontedition@vpr.net. And joining us from Burlington on the phone is Jim. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Hey. Yeah, I'm just going to mention, I went to a hearing about a month or two ago with Dr. Kroc. He did a very good talk about what went on down there. A lot of the stuff and the land was very respected.
And, Jim, you thought that was interesting to hear about the talk, the interactions between settlers and Native Americans?
Yes, and also the way they did the access to the new ferry dock respected the land. He showed one picture of it, what they did on the New York side, and the New York side was all tore up.
Well, Jim, let's get to John Kroc on this. I mean, John, I want to hear from you about this idea of the landscape and respecting the land now and, you know, as far back as you can take us.
Sure. I think that's a great point. The Agency of Transportation has gone to great lengths to preserve the site in the construction of the temporary ferry access. Temporary because it was built on geotextile fabric and fill and can be taken up once the ferry is no longer needed. And I think that's one kind of area of modern archaeology that a lot of people don't understand. We're really advocates for preservation as much as excavation, particularly on a property that's owned by the public. It's state property, and unless it's endangered, there's no real reason to dig it up because archaeology is destructive, even though we take a lot of notes and photographs. You know, but this landscape history is fascinating. You know, you have a narrows of the lake that's only a quarter mile across, obviously a kind of focal point for crossing the lake transportation and communication. Like I mentioned, we have, you know, the earliest dated material there going back to 9,000 years ago. Earlier than that, it was underwater under the Champlain Sea. So we have the earliest evidence of possible right there near the bridge. We also have evidence of trade materials, natives trading. We have Mastassini quartzite, for example, that comes from Quebec, some 330 miles to the north. Galena hematite, a material that was also traded for, not local to Vermont. You know, all these artifacts tell us the story of native communications that weren't written down, that we don't have record of other than the artifacts that remain. And this is a little different when we talk about the French and the early settlement, where we do have historic records. And it's one of the things that makes historic archaeology really fascinating is you can connect up individuals with material culture. And as Gio mentioned, and as Elsa Gilbertson would talk about, the inventory lists of the materials that came in, we know who ordered them, we know who brought them, we know who was there to the name, and we can find these things archaeologically and connect them up with those people and tell the story. And some of those things obviously made it out of the fort and were traded with Native Americans for other materials, and also helped support the French settlement. And so there's a lot to be told right here in this one area, you know, that tells the whole history of Vermont from Native Americans, early settlement, military history, and everything. And it's been quite a privilege to work at this site.
Giovanna Peebles, maybe you can elaborate on that a little bit, because there has been a written record of this fort. There are maps from the 1730s. There are written reports of French activity in this area. So why is it so exciting and important to find the physical artifacts?
I mean, I think John said it so well that so much of our, we live in a very immediate world. We are involved in our day-to-day business. We are involved with schools and work, or trying to find work and trying to pay mortgages and all this stuff. And looking at our history, I think, just given the interest in our lectures, our publications, and in archaeology, is because it gives us this time perspective that things really do last for thousands of years. We can have hope that things continue. Actually, finding the artifacts of these chapters of our history, I think, really are the palpable evidence. And in this particular case, the French fort, if let's just call it the fort for purposes of the radio show, the French settlements are so ephemeral. They're so much like the Indian, the Native American sites where people just recycled virtually everything. And so when we were excavating in 2007, we found so little evidence of the actual settlements. I think many of them are eroded into the lake. And one reason why this little piece of landscape that John and his team have been excavating under the pier is that it's a little bit of bedrock. It's this little peninsula. I'm looking at this picture of from the air taken by Eric Bissett that shows the Crown Point Peninsula and Chimney Point Peninsula. And it's this sacred piece of landscape that, as John said, was used for these thousands of years. And finding the layers that actually can even connect up with a person is, I think that's pretty extraordinary. And I do want to say that at Chimney Point State Historic Site, which opens on Memorial Day, we are going to have an exhibit about the bridge, about the findings from the Consulting Archaeology Program. So, but then go ahead and take the ferry and go over to Crown Point and walk around, and you'll get a sense of why this was sacred space to the Native peoples, to the French, to the English after that. And here we're finding the evidence of the use of these areas.
You know, you just mentioned Crown Point, and we should point out a little bit of the history here. Both this fort on the Vermont side and the French fort at Crown Point on the New York side were built in the 1730s, and the French were defending against the British at that point. But both of these forts were not, well, I guess they were done with in terms of the French by the late 1750s when the British took control in Quebec of all the French possessions in North America. So we saw on Crown Point that the British took over this fort, built a huge fortification that was very important in the Revolutionary War and later. But what happened on the Vermont side when this fort was no longer occupied by the French? John Croft?
Well, it actually goes back even a little bit before that. In 1690, the British actually built a little stone fort at Chimney Point. We don't know exactly where it was. There are no maps. And it was so small, it could be anywhere. It may have been on the same area where the French later built their fort. And so there's quite an interesting back and forth. But it looks like after Fort St. Frederick at Crown Point was constructed, the fort at Chimney Point was destroyed. Later, when the British came in 1759 to Crown Point, they'd found the French had retreated to Quebec, to Canada, and they'd blown up the fort, and then the British built a very substantial fort there. And at that time, they also apparently built some kind of earthwork on the Chimney Point side. But evidence of that hasn't been discovered yet. So there's some open questions about what went on after that. But, you know, soon thereafter, in the late 1700s, it became an operating tavern, the same building roughly. It was built out over the years. But in the late 1790s, the historic site, which you can now visit, was a tavern. It was a functioning tavern up into the early 1900s. So, and I think this continues on this sort of anthropological theme of communication and interaction and trade and transportation and commerce, the same thing that goes on now at the Bridge Restaurant or the West Addison General Store. These were hubs of activity that drew people in from the community, trade and commerce and merchant activity and so on, that continue to sort of mark this area as significant.
Giovanna, we just have a couple seconds left, but I do want to make sure to ask you, how is the discovery of this fort going to impact the new bridge that's being built?
It's not going to delay anything. It's not going to impact anything. We have this pretty extraordinary process nailed down where the archaeology is very much done in sync with the construction schedule. The engineers of the new bridge are extraordinary. They're using the existing piers to the extent possible. So there'll be a very good marriage of the old and the new. And there'll be absolutely no construction delays, no change in schedule. It's just part of us just working that closely together.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing more about what this excavation reveals. John, I assume that you are going to be continuing to excavate.
Yes, we will. And they're working on the final plans, you know, but I will say the final engineering plans are just a beautiful design. It's actually going to span much of this site. So a lot of it that we do designate and can be avoided will be preserved for future archaeologists.
Good to know. We'll have to keep an eye out for what else gets found. Giovanna Peebles is the Vermont State Archaeologist. John Kroc is director of the University of Vermont's Consulting Archaeology Program. Thanks to both of them for being on the show today.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Hardwick is a town known for its history of hard times, but that's begun to change in the last few years as the town has embraced a local sustainable food system. Hardwick and the nearby region are home to several entrepreneurial food-based businesses like Pete's Greens and High Mowing Seeds. Northeast Kingdom writer Ben Hewitt has written a new book that traces the story of Hardwick's food revolution. It's called The Town That Food Saved. Hardwick's median income is 25% below the state average, while unemployment is above the state average. But Hewitt says locally based agriculture provides something that isn't measured in traditional economic models.
You know, in a lot of ways, I think the metrics we apply to our communities are, I think, really faulty, particularly when you have a community as tight-knit as Hardwick and that has a you know, sort of a level of pride and strength and resiliency that I think are really very enviable. So when you start talking about the traditional metrics of unemployment and median income, those are really easy to quantify, but I don't think they really tell the whole story. I think on some level, every town in this country is going to have to figure out a way to create food systems that are not predatory to our land base, to our communities, minds, and bodies, and to our economies in general. And it occurred to me that creating these systems is going to be actually one of the defining issues of the coming decades.
Let's talk a little bit about the systems. I mentioned a few in my introduction: Pete's Greens, Claire's Restaurant, Vermont Soy, High Mowing Seeds. These are all companies, groups, organizations that are centered around Hardwick. So how do they create a small-scale, local, sustainable food system?
There has been, you know, a sort of recent crop of new food-based businesses in Hardwick over the past, you know, roughly 3 to 8 years. But one thing I really tried to do was to sort of explore a little more thoroughly the agricultural history of Hardwick and also some of the other producers, which have sort of quietly been operating in town for quite a long time. And I think, you know, really bring a lot to the table in terms of completing this circle, creating this system that is really quite functional. So I just want to make sure that, you know, people understand that while these guys have been getting a lot of press and are really pushing this forward, there's a lot of other stuff going on in Hardwick that I find to be really inspiring, the sort of quiet heroes of the Hardwick food movement, if that's what we want to call it. I think one of the reasons that it's been so easy to illustrate a healthy food system out of what's happening in Hardwick, you can really boil it down to a handful of businesses. I mean, how many towns in the U.S. do you have a composting outfit, a seed business, and numerous vegetable growers? And if you want to sort of explain to people who aren't familiar with how agriculture really works, it's really easy to draw that circle. And you can point to the compost. You can point to the compost that's nourishing the soil, that's, you know, been sown with the seeds, that's growing the vegetables. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons this town really works as a sort of model of a healthy food system. One of the things I really struggled with in this book was when you're talking about local food systems, is it absolutely essential that that system is feeding the locals, or is it enough for it to provide jobs for the locals and you know, thereby giving them the flexibility to, you know, eat at McDonald's with their wages if that's what they choose to do? And I think I unfortunately couldn't answer that question. It's a very, very tricky thing, I think, in particular in a town like Hardwick where the median income is a little bit lower than average. And so when you have artisan food being produced in town, it's, I think, frankly, difficult for a lot of the local people to afford some of the food that they're actually working to produce or that's being produced in their town. And I don't really come out in judgment, I think, of that circumstance. It's a very, very complex issue.
You don't necessarily come out in judgment of that, but you do have what you think are some guidelines for the way this is going to be scaled across the country. And you have four guidelines, and those are it has to be economically viable for the producers, for the farmers. It has to be based on sunshine, so you can't be using tons of fossil fuel.
Right.
It has to feed the locals, and it has to be circular. But feeding the locals is one of the four keys.
Absolutely. And there's, to my mind, I don't think anyone in Hardwick, you know, any of these producers would disagree with us. I think they're all sort of stuck in the same dichotomy as I get into here, which is that, you know, how can we create economic viability for ourselves, you know, without sort of producing a value-added product that, you know, then by default it needs to go to some place where these people, you know, people can afford to pay that added value. And
right, the $20 blue cheese may be going to Boston, not
right.
being bought.
Although I have to say, I just bought some of that blue cheese and it was only $15. So sorry,
it's
guys,
getting cheaper.
if I misrepresented it. You know, I pick on the cheese quite a bit, not out of any, you know, hard feelings toward the Keelers, but simply I think it's a very sort of emblematic product. It's considered sort of a high-end artisan product, and it is expensive. You know, when I started writing this book, I thought sort of smugly to myself that I was going to be the one to figure out how do we feed locals on good quality food produced in their backyards while ensuring economic viability for the producers. And I think what I've realized is that we have a very complex economic and cultural societal arrangements that include financial arrangements and all sorts of systems that have basically allowed us to spend a mere 9% of our income on putting food on our table. Our entire broader economic arrangement is really predicated on inexpensive food. And so to say, like, oh, well, we're just going to create a local food system and it's going to create economic viability for the producers and it's going to feed the locals, you know, it's really an infinitely more complex issue than that. And I don't see that there, you know, that you can really tease out the food system and separate it from, you know, the financial system, from our cultural system, from all sorts of arrangements that we've created in this country. It's really, you know, sort of one big ball that we now have to sort of start to try to unravel.
You talk in the book about how the national media has really focused on Hardwick and the food systems and some of the colorful names and people that we've already talked about, to the exclusion of some of the producers that have been in the Hardwick area for decades and work perhaps a little under the radar. And when you started doing the research for this book, you realized that not all of the farmers and people in the agricultural producing side of things in the Hardwick area are really pleased about all this attention that's been focused on Hardwick. Can you talk a little bit about that?
You know, I initially was sort of really surprised to learn that there was a little bit of festering tension. You know, and if you have any kind of tight-knit community and all of a sudden you have a media splash and where some people are being, you know, held up as saviors of the town, you know, big surprise. People are going to get, you know, a little bit wonder what's going on. I do think it's a vocal minority, but a really important minority that really deserves to be heard and sort of understood. And it's certainly part of the story.
And what are they angry about?
I think some of them are, you know, they're concerned about gentrification. And I think some of it also has to do with the fact that, you know, there's certainly, I think, a little classism here. I mean, there are the haves and have-nots. You know, I'm not suggesting that everyone who's part of this sort of recent wave of entrepreneurs is wealthy, but they are definitely coming at this from a different place than someone who's been living off the land for 60 years and milking cows their whole life. There's no question about it. They're coming out of college. They're looking for a way to sort of apply their education to the land. I don't want to say it's a different ethos, but it's clearly sort of a different articulation of what's, you know, localized agriculture. You know, I saw a lot, you know, some of the people that I profiled in here, I saw a lot of just really wonderful low-key food exchange. You know, I'd go over to someone's house and there'd be, you know, jam and squash and stuff on the table that they were taking over to someone else. You know, I mean, there's a lot of that sort of just neighbor-to-neighbor food exchange. And I think if we're actually talking about true resiliency in our food systems, the more of that we have, the better. You know, the more people we have actually putting, you know, pulling food out of the soil or in some way creating, you know, food that they can then feed themselves with and share amongst the community, I think absolutely the better.
Ben Hewitt's new book is called The Town That Food Saved, How One Community Found Vitality in Local Food. Ben, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Jane. It was really fun.
And the official launch of the book is tonight at the Galaxy Bookshop in St. Johnsbury. We have more information at vpr.net. A new journal or a fresh sheet of stationery can add something special to the act of writing. But for a Burlington-based art therapy program, making paper is a central part of the creative process.
and the key to a cathartic form of expression. For the past 2 years, the program has been helping soldiers around the country express themselves through the creation of what they call combat paper. VPR's Steve Zind explains.
What we're doing here is we're actively engaging in traditional practices of hand papermaking.
In a converted factory space in Burlington, papermaker Drew Matat runs through a well-rehearsed show-and-tell. Matat is demonstrating a technique similar to the one used for centuries to make paper. The only modern touches are the plastic buckets and the electric motor of a beater, where cut-up bits of cloth are mixed with water. The beater pulverizes the cloth and produces a slurry, which is drained off and poured into a vat of water. Then a screen mounted on a frame is dipped into the vat. The screen collects a fuzzy layer of cloth fibers. Once the water is pressed out and the layer dries, it turns into a sheet of coarse paper. At first glance, this is all pretty straightforward, but we skip the very beginning of the process where the cloth is cut and shredded into small pieces. This cloth comes from military uniforms. Hundreds of them have been cut up into small pieces to make this paper. In most cases, the work has been done by soldiers who wore the uniforms in Iraq and Afghanistan. The paper is then bound into writing journals, or images are silkscreened onto the rough sheets.
One of the things I get really excited about is most of the veterans that we work with, you know, the demographic is somewhere between 20 and 25 for the most part, and they're just back from Iraq or Afghanistan. They have very little art training, and then they really get into it. And also to see folks who suffer from PTSD kind of like starting to reclaim their lives, you know, through this process and through being exposed to a community of veterans who have gone through this process.
Drew Matat, the papermaker, was running a studio in Burlington and conducting art therapy workshops when he met Drew Cameron, the soldier. Cameron was grappling with his feelings after 4 years of active duty that included service in Iraq.
It's just kind of a feeling of being numb more than anything. You know, not happy, not sad, not angry, just like pretty monotone.
Cameron discovered that papermaking and using his military uniform for the raw materials had a therapeutic effect. He and Matat started a collaboration called the Combat Paper Project. Touring the country and even traveling to Canada and the United Kingdom, they've held workshops, residencies, readings, and performances, all based on showing soldiers how to make paper from uniforms and then how to use that paper for writing or art projects. Cameron says the act of making paper from his uniforms was just one part of the therapy for him.
From just being kind of a way to change my relationship with my military experience, you know, to do something very symbolic and literal, was also learning about the commonality of experience that I had with other veterans and how we can make sense of these things together in a group and how we can speak openly and honestly of these things.
Cameron has strong political views against the wars, but he says the statements that emerge from the Combat Paper Project workshops reflect the opinions and feelings of individual soldiers, and they're all different. He says the project isn't about politics so much as giving soldiers a chance to find an outlet and come to terms with their war experiences.
You learn productive and constructive ways to live. It's not getting over it, it's embracing it.
In addition to papermaking, writing is also part of the Combat Paper Project's workshops. John Michael Turner leads the writing sessions.
You can take this uniform, you can bind a book, and then you can write your memories into this book that you can share with other people.
Turner was in the Marine Corps. He deployed twice to Iraq. Like other soldiers, he came to the Combat Paper Project looking for a way to express himself constructively.
When I first started making paper, I had no other outlet. I was taking prescription pills and a lot of alcohol, and that was my method of coping with what had happened.
Turner's created a book of poetry printed on combat paper. He doesn't claim that making paper from military uniforms is going to miraculously make a vet who's hurting whole again, but he says it opens a door
for people to just walk into and see where it takes them. It's really amazing to see what happens, the way people transform themselves after they've taken the initiative of bringing their uniforms to a workshop.
There's a quiet intensity to Turner. He says he still struggles with coming to terms with his war experiences.
A lot of things, they still come back, and they hit pretty hard when they do. But if you keep living in the past, then you're not really living.
As Turner talks and shreds uniforms to make more paper, his mother, Joanne Haschak, watches from across the room. She's visiting him from South Carolina. She says she saw a dramatic change in her son during his military service.
When he first went in, hoorah, Marine, you know, that second bus trip, getting off, no life left in his eyes.
Haschak says she's still concerned about her son, but she can't deny the positive effect of the Combat Paper Project.
And he's happy, you know, and that's the main thing. And there's life back in his eyes, and if it's with this pulp, if that's what it takes, it's okay.
In the coming year, the Combat Paper Project will branch out. They've received grants to work with ex-combatants in Northern Ireland, and this summer will conduct workshops in Bosnia and Herzegovina. For VPR News, I'm Steve Zind.
And that's it for today. Tomorrow on the program, we'll be joined by Rutland Mayor Chris Loris, and we'll be looking at some of the problems facing the city of Rutland. Not the least of them is a child pornography investigation that has affected the city's police department. You can send your questions for Mayor Loris to vermontedition@vpr.net. The program is produced by Patty Daniels, Steve Zind, Sarah Ashworth, and Sarah Yam. Rick Singeri directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening. Thanks for listening. We welcome feedback and suggestions for Vermont Edition. Contact us anytime at vpr.net.